You're listening to the IC Interviews from the Investors Chronicle. I'm Mary McDougall, and today my guest is Ben Rogoff, Lead Manager of Polar Capital Technology Trust, a position he has held since 2006. The Trust's share price has grown by over 550% over the past decade, and it has net assets worth over $2 billion. Ben also manages Polar Capital's open-ended global technology fund and automation and artificial intelligence fund. He has been a technology specialist for 24 years. Hi, Ben. Thanks very much for joining me today. Technology stocks have been one of the few sectors to have very good performance recently, and I'm sure you've got lots of happy shareholders. But people are starting to get nervous about valuations across the sector. What are your thoughts on valuations at the moment?
Well, clearly the tech sector has performed very well before the crisis, and has shone as one of those sectors that has helped deliver, if not salvation, certainly some of the solutions to this fairly unique period in history. And so, the companies are mostly delivering pretty good results, certainly better than feared. And the market has responded, or investors have responded, I should say, by investing more heavily in tech. And there's no doubt valuations have gone up. When you look at the tech sectors, on a forward PE basis, we're sort of post-great financial crisis highs today. And obviously that, leaves people with a sort of, some concern about where valuations lie. I mean, for what it's worth, I've been doing tech for a very long time, and people will want to make the 90s parallel, which we can maybe come back to. But for now, I think it's fair to say that that everything's gone up everything's gone up in price. If you look at the price of gold or the price of silver or real estate in certain markets, and when the risk-free rate the cost of borrowing for companies or the risk-free rate, government rates or whatever it might be, they've obviously plunged before, but also during this crisis. And what that's done is put upward pressure on valuations of everything, particularly long duration assets. And so the kind of punchline for me is that valuations have risen. What we've done in the portfolio is to move away from some of the more exuberant areas and try to reallocate. And of course, that's the beauty of running a portfolio like ours. There are always opportunities to reallocate money where you feel the risk reward is better.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you identify a number of core themes with your investment approach. What themes do you think are looking the most attractive at the moment?
Well, we have 8 core themes in the portfolio. And I mean, if we went back, years, we would have, many of these now seem rather banal, but they're not. They're actually very profound. Things like e-commerce, online advertising, 5G. We're excited about all of those. I would say near term, we would probably highlight something like 5G, where it feels increasingly like a national imperative that that wireless infrastructure is upgraded in order to, well, and particularly with the sort of backdrop of US-Sino relations deteriorating, the need for a 5G network to be the underpinning of a whole, an infrastructure layer, if you like, for things like autonomous vehicles and the Internet of Things, looks very exciting. So we have exposure in there at the infrastructure level, but we also are excited about Apple's upcoming, hopefully, 5G handset launch that should come soon enough, and that might give way to a bunch of sort of a more handset spending, more smartphone unit growth, and that would then sort of create a sort of more virtuous cycle of as it relates to 5G. So we've been reallocating towards 5G. And also towards artificial intelligence, which remains probably the most powerful theme that we invest in, primarily via the cloud companies, but also via a sort of smattering of semiconductor companies. And on the sort of sell side, we've been taking profits in really our favorite area, which is software, where the valuations have clearly moved to levels that we haven't seen this cycle. And that reflects really this new paradigm that we live in, where with kind of work from home and the need to kind of really re-architect people's compute, which has taken people towards software companies that will help them do that.
And do you think, so companies like the ones that have benefited from the working from home, like RingCentral and Zoom, do you think they still have a huge amount to go, or have people sort of installed their work from home setup and maybe the outlook for them is not so good?
It's a great question. And it's always very difficult to get a real time, sort of taking the pulse in real time about penetration rates is no easy thing. You know, we don't own RingCentral right now because, I mean, we've owned it for many, many years, and it just reached a price point that we felt was capturing a lot of the goodness of the, you know, that lies ahead. We still do have some Zoom, but more broadly, I mean, both of those companies play into what we would call the unified communication space. And before we went into this crisis, I think it's fair to say that penetration was probably, i.e., how much of the market had already moved to a virtual telephone system, a cloud telephone system or call center system. And we estimate, or we believe, that number was less than 20%. So, you know, given that we're only sort of 6 months into this, it is highly unlikely that everybody's rolled out, you know, their next generation PBXs and what have you. So I feel like the growth trajectory for those companies is very strong. The challenge is always, and it really is a challenge as a growth investor, is to try and assess, you know, how much of that is already captured in the valuation. And in the case of RingCentral, we felt that it was. And in the case of Zoom, which we still hold, we felt it wasn't. I think you have to sort of ultimately be in the right places, but be prepared to, you know, to exit stocks where you feel like the upside risk is, you know, gated by downside risk. And should a RingCentral miss a quarter, which I doubt it will, but if it did, you know, I would have thought the stock would correct quite meaningfully. So, you know, Zoom, on the other hand, you know, video as an interface, really, we haven't seen this before. I've been doing this for 20 odd years, and video conferencing has always been one of those impossible things to solve for. And, you know, here's Zoom, and it's clearly solved for it. And now we can start to see Zoom monetize some of those free users, millions of free users. But also, I think they might, you know, be interested in trying to verticalize their solutions and start moving into, you know, a slightly more fully featured solution set, which would take them into a very different and much larger market opportunity. So we've kept that one.
Just stepping back a bit, over 70% of your funds in the US, what impact do you think the upcoming election could have on the tech sector?
Well, that's a great question. It's a great question because obviously the, you know, politics globally, or certainly in the markets, matter to us is as polarized as we can remember. And I suspect that a Biden or Democrat clean sweep would be probably met with some nervousness by investors, because ultimately of spending plans that, again, it's very difficult to know exactly what will be delivered by a Democratic administration. But I think the risk would be to corporate tax rates and, you know, perhaps a slightly different regulatory backdrop for some of my companies. And then the prospect of healthcare reform and who would pay for that and how it would be funded. So, yeah, I think broadly speaking, it would be a clean sweep would be perceived or greeted with some caution. But I think, you know, polls are to be treated with caution, aren't they? Who knows if the stock market can hold together or if we can make further progress on coronavirus, you know, before we get to that all important November moment. Perhaps Donald Trump will become the most unlikely two-term president in modern history.
Yeah, it's impossible to predict, really.
Indeed.
It's interesting you mentioned regulatory threats. The tech sector is very concentrated. Is regulation something that you worry about?
Well, I mean, regulation exists to protect consumers and to protect other businesses from, you know, from bigger businesses that may be using unfair practices. And look, it's very difficult. I think from our perspective, we've long argued that the companies that are typically talked about, the, you know, obviously Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, the very large technology platforms, by nature of their size and dominance of their markets, will always have, certainly for some years now, fallen under the sort of a greater regulatory scrutiny. I don't think that's going away. The question of whether or not that's appropriate or not, I think, is difficult. My own view is that these are, you know, natural monopolies rather than sort of, I don't know, analogous to sort of the kind of robber barons of the Gilded Age, where, you know, a Rockefeller might have had 90% market share of, I don't know, refinery capacity in North America, and Google may have 90%. Market share of search, for example. And so through a particular lens, they might look like they're monopolists. But in the end, and I think this is a position that I feel very comfortable sort of maintaining, these companies, our companies, have delivered incredible value to people. And ultimately, the utility that's been delivered by the likes of Google and Facebook, which again are sort of struggling to keep all of their billions of people, customers, happy, it would seem, particularly in, you know, some of these social media situations at the moment. But ultimately, the credible value that they delivered, offering services for nothing. If you think about how, you know, someone like Google has been delivering its classroom product for free during this crisis, that's helped, you know, schools stay online and being able to teach pupils remotely. You know? So it's a difficult one. In the end, the question for me would be, what does regulation look like? And I think I feel it will fall short of breaking up these companies, like some on the Democrat side of the house would like to see. I think that what we'll probably end up doing is having a sort of a tougher environment for M&A for those companies. So, you know, would Facebook be able to buy Instagram now? Unlikely. And perhaps more taxation. So when we model our companies, and we obviously have investments in most of these companies, we just naturally assume a kind of an increasing rate of tax that will, I think, be probably the blunt instrument supplied to these companies in the end.
You mentioned Chinese and US trade tensions earlier. How might these affect any of the holdings in your fund?
Wow, that's a conundrum. I mean, I don't know how long we have, but I mean, it's very difficult to say because ultimately, we've written about this in, you know, annual reports in previous years. If your, you know, listeners are interested, pick up and have a read. But we, you know, it's very difficult. Both countries, the US and China, have obviously got a great shared interest in not, you know, plunging the world into a greater sort of economic, you know, situation than we're in already. But both appear to be on a very clear collision course as it relates to technology supremacy. It's one of the reasons, actually, why I'm relatively relaxed about regulation, because if you think about the risk that the US sees in China, wanting to sort of take on the reins in things like artificial intelligence, but also in chip manufacturing and design and lots of other areas that the US really leads in today. You know, when you think about the Googles and Facebooks and Apples and Amazons, these are at the vanguard of the US tech effort. And so the idea that they're going to be kneecapped by regulators just at a point when the Chinese are kind of coming out on the outside rail seems highly unlikely to me. So I think that more friction is inevitable between these two superpowers. And I think on the whole, as long as, you know, hot war, if you like, can be avoided, it should be pretty good for our space. You know, the internet companies are largely distinct. So, you know, Google and Facebook aren't allowed to operate there anyway. Our payment companies are distinct. There's very little payment exposure in China. And the Chinese companies dominate their, you know, sphere of influence, the Alibabas and Tencents, which we have in the portfolio and have had for years. And so I'm kind of hopeful that that will be just fine. Where there is more friction is in things like telecommunication, where you're seeing Huawei increasingly under the spotlight. Huawei is private, so we don't have any direct exposure, but we do have exposure to Ericsson. That may do well, yeah, actually, if Huawei is banned in certain Western markets. Ericsson, we haven't owned for a long time, is now in the portfolio because if it's ever going to do well, it's going to be doing well when countries are rolling out 5G, and where Huawei is, you know, unable to be a price disruptor. And then we also have chip companies that do well, kind of regardless, because they sell to either a Huawei or to an Ericsson. So I think the question ultimately is, can a worst case outcome be avoided? And I think for the foreseeable future, the answer is yes. But, you know, should we have a genuine falling out? And of course, the Biden administration may end up, you know, taking the US on a different course entirely. So I think for now, we're relatively sanguine about, you know, the risks associated with the sort of US-Sino issues. But to be clear, the countries are on a clear collision course. And that means that, you know, friction is all you can ultimately do is sort of kick the can. But at some point, there will have to be a conversation about how much IP transference America will accept, you know, from US to China in the form of things like semiconductor equipment companies, chips, and so on. And so it's a very fluid, slightly alarming on a medium-term basis. But near-term, I think everybody wants to avoid a kind of an outright conflict.
What position is Taiwan Semiconductor in at the moment? I noticed they're in your top 10.
Yeah, we've owned this one for a very long time. You know, the story here is that TSMC, as it's kind of widely known, has moved into the sort of leadership position in terms of leading edge manufacturing, by which I mean for years and years and years, in fact, the whole history of my experience in the industry, but for, you know, 20 years of semiconductor history, Intel has been the leading edge, or the leader in the leading edge. In other words, as chip designs shrink and Yeah, designs get ever smaller and faster. Intel has been in the lead, and maybe a couple of years ago, TSMC took that lead, and that lead is now extending. And over the last few days, you've seen Intel, which we do have a tiny position in, maybe 50 basis points, but you know we have a much larger position in TSMC and a much larger position in AMD. Intel is sort of half thrown in the towel, literally half thrown in the towel over the last few days, and has said it's really struggling to get down to its, you know, at its leading edge geometries. And TSMC now looks, you know, genuinely in pole position, and there's a good chance that Intel may look to outsource manufacturing to TSMC. So wow, what a change in 2 years! And you know, but it's obviously been a long work in progress, and an incredible kind of hat tip to TSMC that they've done that. But another good reminder, if you think that, you know, Taiwan is just an island off mainland China, and Intel, that was the kind of US bastion of semiconductor manufacturing, has just sort of, you know, thrown in the proverbial towel. And so good reminder of the direction of travel. But it's been great for us in the portfolio, because AMD, which is a large position for us and has been for a number of years, Intel's arch rival, has already been benefiting from TSMC's manufacturing capability and has been growing its market share at the expense of Intel. And that stock has been fantastic. And now TSMC is moving, you know, because ultimately I think the market has realized that the valuation of that one, which has been relatively undemanding actually for some time, doesn't reflect now its leadership position.
How do you feel about your Chinese holdings? Because we had Carson Block of Muddy Waters on our podcast recently, who said he deemed China pretty much uninvestable.
Well, I think people have been saying that for a long time. I mean, I think that ultimately you have to get comfort with, you know, the regime that you're, or at least the, you know, the political backdrop of China. And, you know, I just, you know, for what it's worth, our own exposure is very conservative. You know, we have big positions in Tencent and in Alibaba. We have a tiny position in Baidu as a sort of value turnaround sum of parts story. But I mean, you know, it's the first two holdings are much, much larger and have featured in our top 10 for years. So beyond those, there really is nothing in our portfolio. We don't hold A shares. We don't have anything, you know, esoteric. And our own lesson was learned in 2006, actually, where we had a handful of small and mid-cap stocks. And it was before people really understood this concept of the variable interest entity, the VIE structures that people, that some investors are still very leery of today, where you don't ultimately own the underlying, you know, because ultimately there are sectors within the Chinese market and economy that foreign investors are not allowed to own. And one of those is tech. And one way around that is to create a legal entity, the VIE, which is an offshore company that then owns the underlying assets. And in 2006, we were caught out in the tail of our portfolio in very small holdings, but we learned that ultimately the balance sheets didn't belong to us, the foreign investor, they belong to the local business. And so as a result of that experience, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And we've gone into our own Chinese investment in a very, you know, careful way. So ultimately, very liquid companies that if we wanted to exit tomorrow, we could exit with, you know, no one would notice. So, you know, again, I'm not bearish on China. I'd like to own more there, actually, I think, on balance. And, you know, I think over time, I would expect the investment backdrop to become friendlier, actually, not the other way around.
It's interesting. And let's talk about some of your big US stocks. Amazon's sure. Amazon's quite a small holding relatively at 2%. Why is this?
Well, so the way that we run money in the trust, particularly at Polar, is very much with an eye to the benchmark. And my view has always been that if we can deliver 2-3% per annum outperformance against our benchmark, which is a very good benchmark, by the way. And we can do that and do it, you know, in a year in, year out, we can compound returns at, you know, very attractive levels. And that is, without wanting to sound boastful, exactly what we have done. So when I look about the position sizes, when you think about position sizes in the trust, you have to sort of have a sort of sideways glance at what they are in the benchmark. And so Amazon today is around 3% of the trust, which looks like a sort of middle-sized position, or, you know, not certainly not one of the largest, but actually it's a zero in our benchmark.
Yeah.
And as a result, it's actually the single largest relative bet that we're making against that benchmark. So we're very fond of it. We've liked it for a very long time, ever since we really discovered about AWS and their, you know, public cloud business, which has really changed the entire economics of that company, providing them with the cash flow they need to invest for growth. And what a great job they've done. So we're really excited about the company. You know, the cloud story there is what excites us still. they're obviously benefiting greatly from work from home and all the disruption to the high street that we're seeing. And then there's a whole bunch of optionality in that business that we don't think is captured in the price. So we're still believers. We like that one. As I say, it's one of the biggest relative bets that we have, even if the absolute isn't as big as it might be.
So could I argue that your loyalty to the benchmark has been a drag on performance in that instance?
You could try, but I'd like to see the numbers before I agreed to your view. I mean, ultimately, I've had Apple in the portfolio since 2003. I've owned more Apple as a result of the benchmark than I would have. I probably own more Apple than anybody, or certainly I think anybody in the UK, actually. It's a big statement to make. But, you know, my benchmark has 14% of Apple, and Apple is a $1.7 trillion business. And in 2003, you couldn't find a person that would buy the stock. And I bought it on the 1st of May, 2003, because it was doing a bit better and it was in my benchmark. And so the benchmark has, you know, there are times where you wish it had some Amazon. I would have held more. If the benchmark had some Tesla, might I have bought some earlier, possibly. I think in the round, the benchmark has delivered very strong returns. It's outperformed most of my peers, or certainly many of my peers, maybe not UK peers, but when you think about the, you know, the tech universe of open-ended competition, the benchmark has done a pretty good job. And we've been, you know, pretty much beating it by 2-3% per annum for the last decade. So no, I don't think so. We have we have another product that we run, our open-ended UCITS product.
It soft closed recently.
We soft closed it recently, yes, to make sure that the available capacity, and there's a fair bit, but the available capacity was available to existing holders rather than to new ones. But Nick and I have run the portfolio side by side for a very long time. We've worked together now since 2007. So, you know, we're capturing the same themes, the same names, just in slightly different shapes.
And you mentioned Tesla. Do you hold Tesla at the moment?
We have a small position, sort of 60 basis points. I mean, our investment process, and I'm not going to bore everyone with the details, but the punchline ultimately is we think about returns with a very keen eye on risk. We really do. And there are periods where other funds and trusts can perform much better than us because they're concentrated and maybe they have less concern about near-term risk and they're much longer-term investors. We are sort of paranoid tech investors. We understand that change occurs all the time and that there's really very little permanence in tech. And I know that from 25 years of doing this. And so we typically invest in themes and companies where they're about to inflect positively, where companies look expensive but actually aren't. And we bought Salesforce.com and Facebook in the IPO, and we bought Google at the IPO that very few people did. But there are so that works most of the time. There are some companies, however, that are more binary, where you're ultimately having to make a bet that, you know, all the value in the business is at the end of its life, you know, the very longest duration companies. Tesla is still probably a classic binary company where if things go well, this company could have 10% market share of, you know, global auto units, in which case it's meaningfully undervalued. If things go badly, it might be worthless. And I think, you know, some years ago, one could have said the same about Netflix, which is another company that our investment process isn't ideal for identifying those companies. So thankfully, we do have some Netflix and we do have some Tesla. They both delivered really strong returns for us, but they're not the largest names in our portfolio, in part as well because they're, again, not in our benchmark, but mostly because they're binary.
Okay. So Microsoft, Alphabet and Apple, between them, make up nearly a quarter of the fund.
Yes. They are not binary. They're wonderful, wonderful businesses. Wonderful businesses that we've owned for many, many years. And, you know, right now, actually, we're underweight all of those companies. So they're a larger part collectively of our benchmark. Apple is, you know, one of the most unique businesses that we've ever met. It's, you know, had a meaningful re-rating recently, which, you know, means that expectations are certainly elevated as we move into their 5G cycle. But I think what we've learned is, and I think it's an argument, by the way, that I've been making for, I would say, at least six, seven years, that this company ultimately needed to be re-rated and rethought of, not as a tech company, but actually as a mass affluent consumer brand business, where the recurring revenues are really the, you know, and the affluent customer base is really the difference between it and its competitors. And that's happened. I mean, you know, the services part of that story continues to grow. And, you know, maybe there'll be some, you know, regulatory scrutiny of how the company operates its marketplace. But in the end, you know, that the app economy that Apple has enabled is, you know, mind-boggling, world-changing, and has delivered huge value to people. So we still like Apple very much, but expectations are higher. Google, you know, again, I think feeling some of the negative, you know, macro headwinds that everybody's feeling right now, but lots of optionality in the business. And, you know, there the regulatory risk is greater. And so our position size, our underweight position is, you know, has been growing, but we still like it. And pound for pound, it's a very attractively valued company. And then Microsoft, you know, this is the one that disproves the rule that companies, tech companies don't reinvent themselves. I suppose you could say the same about Apple. We still like Microsoft a lot. It's tough to think how the world would have carried on spinning without, you know, it, Office 365 and Teams. And its cloud businesses continue to do very well, but it's quite well owned. And at the margin, we've been taking profits and moving, you know, the money elsewhere. But these are great companies that trade on, you know, reasonable valuations, and therefore are likely to remain core holdings for us.
I was pleased to see NVIDIA in there. I just thought it's a really good company that might be lesser known among our listeners. Can you tell us a bit about what they do and why you like it?
Yes, it's a graphics. I mean, ultimately, this company was one of a few graphics processor companies that were making graphics cards for, you know, computer gamers, really, back in the day. And it, you know, turns out that the same processors that we use to make to move images very rapidly across a monitor are, you know, critical to playing games. And particularly at the high end of gaming, the same idea of manipulating video is the same thing that's being used to train neural networks for machine learning and AI, taking lots and lots of pictures of something and being ultimately able to train a computer to recognize patterns, is the kind of almost reverse process of being able to, you know, display games on a PC. So the graphics processor has become something much more important than it ever was, and now is the kind of key component in the training or process of machine learning and AI. And, you know, as a result, it's one of the kind of core ways that we play the artificial intelligence theme.
Nice. Who would their biggest direct competitors be?
Well, I mean, they saw off most of their competitors, and they've now created a, you know, the barrier to entry there is obviously they've got a lot of experience in GPUs and graphics processors, but they also have created a kind of programming language called CUDA, which again is a, you know, very it's proprietary, so that it's a huge barrier to kind of competition. They're, you know, on the surface, and their most obvious competitor is AMD, which we also have a, you know, a good position in, and have owned really since that stock was a very low single digit price. I mean, that's been one of our best investments really over the last, I suppose, half decade. AMD is their biggest competitor in discrete GPU. But both companies can coexist very nicely, because AMD's success will likely come at the expense of Intel. And hopefully machine learning will be helpful to AMD as well. But we like both of those companies at the expense, truthfully, of Intel and the sort of old way of computing.
A few questions about the trust itself.
Would
you ever consider investing in unquoted stocks? Like, I guess it wouldn't work for your benchmark approach, but it is something that, you know, company trust like Scottish Mortgage have been doing more. And
yeah, they've done a great job. And I think we are asked that question, you know, regularly, and I totally understand the question. You know, companies are staying private for longer, because of the availability of capital in, you know, private markets and non-conventional private, you know, investors. We've sort of ruled it out. You know, we have a large team. We're capable of investing in privates if that's what we decided to do. We decided against, because in the end, it comes back to that idea of being, you know, able to change our minds. One of the things I've learned, and truthfully, anyone that's followed the way, you know, what we've written or how we invest over the years, this won't come as a shock. But the way I typically attack the tech space is to, you know, think about thematically where we need to be invested, but also where we don't need to be invested. And I studied history at university, and I think that what the tech sector has been going through prior and I guess during COVID has been this idea that we're moving from a kind of highly bespoke enterprise, you know, a company-oriented form of technology, moving to a mass production alternative where the mass production, like steel, is being done in clouds. public cloud computing. I've been slightly obsessed about this for a long period of time. And that model is definitely happening now with, 20, 25% of the world's compute now in public clouds. So the experience of previous, industries that have moved through these sort of game-changing transitions is that it's very difficult to know which of the automakers to own. At the turn of the automotive era, it's much easier to not own anything that makes, anything to do with horse and carriages. And one of the things that we've done really well over time, if I may say, is avoiding the wrong stuff and, identifying what not to own has delivered, I think, a fair amount of value to our shareholders. So the point of that kind of digression is that I the most important thing for Nick and I, as we manage, what is now $9 or $10 trillion of money and, investors' money, is the ability to change our minds. Liquid is the absolute paramount thing for us. I mean, obviously owning the right stocks is the most important thing. But the second most important thing is to make sure that if we're wrong, or if technology change occurs in ways that we couldn't or didn't perceive, that we can change our minds. And so in that sense, private companies, we will never be able to do that. We will never get comfort with the illiquidity associated with those companies. And if that means that we end up with a slightly smaller investment universe as a result, so be it. Because in the end, most, if not all, companies come public. And some go off to be tremendous successes. And we wish that we had owned them earlier in their life cycles. But others come to the public market and have much more mixed experiences. And I think people tend to over index the ones that we should have bought when they were private and forget the ones that disappeared into the sort of graveyard of technology history. So we're happy where we are, public market investors with a very strong eye on liquidity.
Yeah. I'm sure people who invested with Neil Woodford would sympathize with that approach.
Horses for courses.
How do you define what a technology stock is?
That's a great question.
You're happy to go off index, but...
Yes, we are. And I think that we're very careful about where the line is. But I think that it's very important to understand that the line is moving. And I think when you think about the way that the index is constructed, that tells you that that's true, because Amazon's still not there because it's perceived as a retailer, and Tesla will be presumably in the automotive part of the index, and so on. And so I think the way that we think about it ultimately is, could this company exist without the internet? Could we buy shares in Sports Direct because they have a great online presence? And the answer for us would be no. This is a retailer with a, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it has an online presence. So for us, the internet is a very interesting line. Could a company exist with or without it? And if so, then that's not for us. Likewise, with companies like Amazon and Tesla, I think, the use of technology to transform a market, could Tesla exist without the electric, without a battery or a powertrain? No, clearly not. And so that would very much fall within the remit. But it's this bit is the art and not a science. I think shareholders should know that they've got a very strong board of directors scrutinizing what we're doing and making sure that we don't veer too far off piste. My own inclination is not to anyway. But we've looked and we've made a small investment in Shimano, which you might know as a company that makes components in bikes. And so that's probably about as left field as we've been for a while. But the story there is not only that is there a cycle boom on because of COVID and this sort of different way of life that people are living, but they also have an e-bike story, which is very interesting. And so I think we're prepared to push on where the boundary is, but we haven't bought companies that are involved in insurance because they're using new AI technologies to improve their profitability. That for us would be too far.
Have you ever been tempted to shrink the number of holdings in the trust?
Well, I think the number of holdings in the trust reflects two things. It reflects how much we like the very largest companies in our benchmark. It reflects the availability of good ideas at the right prices, elsewhere. And so right now, truthfully, we have been shrinking. We've taken it down probably by 15, on average, 15 holdings towards the 100 mark or thereabouts. I think ultimately what we typically will move that around as, if the team comes up with a flurry of very interesting ideas, we'll make way for some more names. But I think the level we're at right now feels about right. If the question is about concentration, we're never going to move the portfolio to a world where we have 4% in Tesla or 7% in, we're just not, because the index ultimately will probably explain the largest positions in the trust going forward.
I was going to say the trust was trading at a premium of over 5% earlier this month, and today it's it looks like it's at a discount of 4%. Are you doing anything to control the premium?
Well, there's no formal. The answer to the question is there's no formal discount mechanism at PCT. There certainly hasn't been during my time at Polar, but we have bought back one third of the company's outstanding shares and cancelled those shares, not held them in treasury, over the course of the company's life. So, we're always alive to, the risk, if you like, or we've certainly proven that we're a buyer when others aren't. In terms of issuance, the issuance is ultimately there because what we don't want to see, or at least I think it's not in anyone's interest to see a premium move, very significantly higher. And that was the experience of this trust and others during the 90s. For extended periods of time, the trust traded on a premium. And if the situation changed, and we don't think this is, the 90s parallel is too easy. But ultimately, we don't think it's actually right. But if the world was to change dramatically, there would be the NAV would struggle, and we don't really want to compound that with a very big move and from a big premium to a big discount. So issuance is there just to help manage that process. And we would do the same if the discount was to stay at a sustained level, but we haven't given a number and we never have. But I hopefully your listeners will be reassured that we have a very strong history of having bought back large amounts of stock if required.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking there's no gearing at the moment?
No, it's one of my, failings is probably the right word, in that I felt that the underlying portfolio had enough sort of operating leverage, by which I mean when tech companies do well, the incremental margins are very high. And so I felt that, and likewise, conversely, when things aren't so good, the incremental margins are so high that when a business's revenues fall by a small amount, they can have a disproportionate impact on earnings. So I've long argued and felt that we didn't need to have sort of structural gearing in the portfolio. We have the availability, we have some gearing that we've taken on that we're a small amount of borrowings that will allow us on a really bad day, if we wanted to go geared, and we have done on a handful of occasions since the financial crisis, but we don't think about gearing as something that we would structurally apply. And given that your first question opened with the valuation conundrum, it's unlikely that we would be geared today. So right now we're at more like a net cash position of about 5%, and with that we also have a small amount of NASDAQ put options that are designed to slightly soften the impact of a sell-off should one occur. But again, very modest stuff, which acts more like 1-2% additional cash.
Great, thank you. One more question. Which companies have you been adding to recently, most recently?
We've added to a fair number, but we've been adding into, let's have a think, areas that would be of interest to you. Well, we've been adding into Ericsson. We thought that was, a better quarter. For margins, we think that the upside from a better sort of landscape of competition is likely to be felt in margins. We've added to Samsung, which again looks pretty cheap, and there's a potential story there in that they're also a leading edge manufacturer of chips. That TSMC share price has just gone vertical on this Intel development, and it's possible that maybe Samsung could be a beneficiary. So we've been adding there actually just this morning. We've added to a bunch of other companies that are exposed. We've had more Netflix recently, where the stock has pulled back after what was a pretty strong quarter, but the expectations may have been slightly set higher. We feel that the backdrop for Netflix is astonishing, not only in its kind of core guise, but also if you think about the conundrum faced by cinemas and movie companies, and how will you release films to cinemas that are half empty? Is there optionality at Netflix that isn't being reflected in the valuation? So we're always in the market doing something, but there's a few names to think about.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. It was really good to have you on. Thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.